This episode, I'm joined once again by Paul Bishop to discuss his recently released book, Discourses of Philology and Theology in Nietzsche, From the Untimelies to the Antichrist. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you'd like to support the podcast, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Paul Bishop, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Glad to be back.
We are going to be discussing your recently released book, Discourses of Philology and Theology in Nietzsche, From the Untimelies to the Antichrist, which was published 2023, which is already last year. And this is a book, as people would imagine, on the work of Friedrich Nietzsche in relation to theology, which is obviously one of the primary aspects that people are tackling with Nietzsche, with the death of God. Atheism to a degree, which we'll probably very quickly go through, but we also went through that in our discussion with the Antichrist, but also the very often overlooked aspect of Nietzschean scholarship, at least from my own appreciation, which is really where Nietzsche himself starts, which is philology. So I begin by asking, another book on Nietzsche. How did this? What's the genesis of this text?
How did I allow that to happen? That's a very good question. I suppose in part it is, you've touched on something there, that it is very hard to get away from Nietzsche, or at least I find it is. There is something about his formulations which is extraordinarily compelling. I find that he also does still speak very much to us. You were saying time goes fast. Well, you know, we're well over a century away from Nietzsche, and yet he seems in a way more timely and in a different way untimely than ever before. The immediate context was, you mentioned that I'd done a little book on the Antichrist, and I think when I started to work on that, it suddenly realized there's a much bigger picture behind Nietzsche's approach to Christianity and his critique of it. So whilst I wanted to focus in that earlier little book on the one specific text, The Antichrist, it became clear to me that I think there's a bigger story to be told around the relationship between these discourses of philology and theology in his work, and help explain why, at least for me, he is untimely in the sense that he's asking these questions, which are still very unsettling for us, and timely because somebody's got to ask them, and Nietzsche does.
An extension, in a way, to that, to the often condensed Nietzschean atheism, Nietzschean appreciation of Christianity and Christ, which is, you know, if you have that sort of stereotypical view of Nietzsche, then a book like The Antichrist will open that up, and you go, "Huh, okay, it's not as straightforward as I thought." But one thing I think I want to start with, and I actually double checked this fact, because there's many, many amazing facts in Nietzsche's life, biographically speaking, but the one that I come back to time and time again within the respective context of our own culture is, he was head of philology, and I was thinking this morning, I think it was 26, no, he was 24 when he was head of philology. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, I mean, nowadays, and he hadn't even passed his doctorate yet.
Yeah.
And so if there is a sort of a textual professional testament to his genius, imagine going to university and the head of your department is 24 years old. So where does his, I guess, biographically, why is he so interested in philology before all other things in a serious sense?
Yeah, no, I think you make a very valuable point there. I certainly think HR policies and procedures wouldn't allow that to happen today. I think probably HR might have a lot of problems with Nietzsche in other respects too. He's appointed to this extraordinary chair of philology in Basel, but he also does a lot of teaching with it. He's not just some ivory tower academic, but he does a lot of teaching in the local gymnasium as well. And there's an interesting backstory, I think, to how that happened, and that is the fact that he was very much regarded as, you know, the future of philology by his doctoral supervisor, Ritschl, and Ritschl sort of gets this post in Bonn, and Ritschl gets this post set up for him in Basel, and lo and behold, Nietzsche goes over, and then after a couple of years, becomes disaffected with philology, and actually starts to turn against it. And the most immediate expression of that, or the most immediate expression that something's not quite right from Ritschl's perspective, so from the perspective of orthodox philology or respected philology, if you like, is The Birth of Tragedy, because it hasn't got any footnotes. I mean, and because it's The Birth of Tragedy, so it's this, as you know, an extraordinary, wild, extraordinary account of the birth of tragedy, with a play on to Wagner and lots of contemporary Kulturkritik thrown in as well. That's not what the Faculty of Basel, that's not what Ritschl, that's not what the school of philologists were expecting from Nietzsche. And they gave him a very hard press for it. Book was negatively reviewed in certain quarters by Willemowitz Möllendorf in particular. And it turns like all these things do into a kind of a streit, a point of disputation. But Nietzsche's very much wounded from that. And I think, as becomes clear from his correspondence with Erwin Rohde, he starts to become disaffected with philology, and in particular, philology as a kind of key subject in the 19th century university. And actually, he starts to get fed up with the university as well, and the whole institution of learning. He delivers these lectures on the future of our institutions of learning, which is a hugely powerful critique of the universities in the 19th century. A hugely powerful and even more mega powerful critique of our university and college system today. So that's again another aspect where Nietzsche is somebody who's important for our time.
Mm. Was he following in the footsteps of his sort of mentor, Schopenhauer, at that point? Schopenhauer famously having his own essays against education.
I think that's a very shrewd observation, and that is definitely part of it. One of the things that The Birth of Tragedy does is to introduce Schopenhauer categories, and in fact, there's some large extracts of a quotation from World as Will and Representation. And again, that is problematic, I think, for the philologists in two ways. Because Schopenhauer is not a philologist, so why are you quoting him? And because Schopenhauer, whose criticism of Hegel is that, you know, this is all entirely wrong and this is just bogus and it's not connecting to reality and it's missing out on the important existential things which Schopenhauer thinks his thought can address. It's another signal that's set by Nietzsche, which is to say, I regard philology not just as a dry academic exercise, to something which has existential import. And that's one of the things which I think many of the academics don't forgive him for, is that Nietzsche thinks these things really do matter.
Yeah, that's still appropriate. Dare I say it?
You dare.
But I guess to open up the big discussion then of the book in a way, not to centralize the whole thing, but there's a split, which you mentioned very early on, and to quote yourself, we have to appreciate how it operates with two different discourses, one indexed to belief, faith, and liturgy, i.e. the discourse of theology, and another indexed to analytical reason, skeptical investigation, and logical argumentation, as well as historical context and linguistic precision, i.e. the discourse of philology. So, though, you know, you're not setting these up as a binary, you know, or you know, a horrible dialectic or something like that. They're not in a relationship in that sense. But what do you think it is for Nietzsche in a way then? Do you see him as moving from the failure he feels from theology, philology, the failure he sees there, it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't work. He moves, as you say, to The Birth of Tragedy without footnotes. Is the next discourse he moves to, which is sort of appropriate, theology, primarily theological, though? And also, I guess a further question from that is, could we ever consider, we'll get to why this might be the case, could we also ever consider Nietzsche a theologian?
Yeah, very good question there. I think, okay, theology is the logos about God. It's what, it's about religion, the sacred. Philology is, if you like, as a love of language and learning, articulation is how we talk and write about that subject. And I think we can see that what happens in the case of Nietzsche is that it reveals him to be, we might say, an ancestor of the linguistic term in philosophy. In other words, what Nietzsche wants to argue is that the philological weaknesses of Christianity undermine, vitiate its theological credibility. And so I think Nietzsche introduces us to a kind of double crisis, a crisis of language, a crisis in philology, and again, at the same time, partly through his contact with Schopenhauer, partly through his sense of disaffection with his experience of the church and believers, he faces a crisis in theology as well. And I think that what I wanted to argue in the book was to take seriously Nietzsche's point that philology is immensely important, and to see that he uses it as a weapon, as he would see it, to finally dispatch a belief. And that lies, I think, behind this whole impassioned rhetoric of the death of God. It's something which is not an academic exercise. It's philology makes it clear to us why God has to die, put in those terms.
What does a philological assessment of scripture say then in terms of the reason as to why God has to die? I'll just add to that, because I think whenever we just discuss Nietzsche, and there's always this shadow in the background of, I don't know what the name is. I wonder if Nietzschean conferences have a name for it. But the two-dimensional Nietzsche, that is, you know, God is dead, spray painted on a wall, the nihilistic idea that Nietzsche is a nihilist where he completely isn't. And so, you know, in a way, it seems we're always battling against it. And so to move away from that sort of somewhat edgy idea of God is, you know, God is just saying God is dead, the philology here is sort of this foundation to say, you know, no, you know, Nietzsche wasn't just approaching this as a sort of solely as a work of, say, like poetry or prose or just a literary attack. There was a foundation. And you know, so do you think philology gives the professional reasons as to why this is the case?
I think that's right. Christianity always presents itself as a philological exercise, as a textual exercise, in ways that we perhaps tend to overlook. And we can talk about how that philology works simply by looking at the difference of names in the Bible. So Jesus, identical to the name of Joshua, means God saves, Yahweh is salvation. Christ, the anointed one, Christ, comes from Bethlehem, the house of bread. We have the whole rhetoric of bread, miracles with bread, and so on. After the crucifixion, in the gospel accounts, Christ is buried by Joseph of Arimathea. The name Arimathea means after death. So we have Joseph, the one who buries. And we start to see the textual way that Christianity is built up, and this is something which the early church fathers are most insistent upon. In fact, for them, I think one could say it's a major argument for believing in God and for believing in particular in Yahweh and believing in Christ. But I think if we look at, I mean, the key passage here, for example, I think is one that we find in his book Daybreak, section 84, entitled The Philology of Christianity. I think we can see here Nietzsche very, very clearly setting out what he objects to, and it echoes his sense of disaffection with philology as well. In this passage, he writes, he says, "How little Christianity educates the sense of honesty and justice can be gauged fairly well from the character of its scholars' writings. They present their conjectures as boldly as if they were dogmas and are rarely in any honest perplexity over the interpretation of a passage in the Bible. Again and again they say, 'I am right, for it is written,' and then follows an interpretation of such impudent arbitrariness that a philologist who hears it is caught between rage and laughter and asks himself, is it possible? Is this honourable? Is it even decent? So I think that gives a sense of how powerful Nietzsche sees this tool of philology is. And then what he objects to is fundamentally that, you know, it does not stack up in linguistic philological terms. He says, how much dishonesty in this matter is still practiced in Protestant pulpits? We might want to talk about Protestantism as a kind of a key background to where Nietzsche's coming from with this. How grossly the preacher exploits the advantage that no one is going to interrupt him here. How the Bible is pummeled and punched, and the art of reading badly is in all due form and passage to the people. Mm. And I think that passage shows why Nietzsche objects quite so strongly to the way that Christianity operates. And he gives these nice examples about, you know, whenever you see a piece of wood, a rod, a ladder, a twig, a tree mentioned, then that's always going to have to be the wood of the cross. When Moses at one point has to spread out his arms to stop the battle against the Amalekites, this is then read by the church fathers as a kind of prefiguration of the crucifixion. And Nietzsche asks, and he often does this. There are other passages where he does this too. He puts it in the form of a rhetorical question. He says, has anyone who asserted this ever believed it? And that, I think, is his philological argument against Christianity in a nutshell.
Mm. So this is it's something I discussed. I can't remember what other discussion it was that I was having. But I think there's two sides to this happening at the same time of history, both explicitly mentioned and also by someone else that we've spoken about on the podcast before in relation to Nietzsche. So we have Rudolf Steiner, who would say that the future is going to be every man has his own religion, you know, almost his own Protestantism. And this seems for Steiner to be, I would say, optimistic, that there's a potential for that to be a good thing, possibly. Nietzsche, however, you know, this is a paraphrase from memory, says that once we start to deconstruct the Bible, the whole thing just crumbles and is destroyed. So that's the sort of pessimistic view. And you mentioned there that quote where Nietzsche says, you know, has anyone even questioned if this is decent? You know, there's sort of, we could say, just a leaning on reason and one side of everything to justify something that it completely isn't. So the question, there's something missing. What do you think that thing is that's missing for Nietzsche for it to metaphorically become something that's decent? And can it be retrieved?
Yeah. I think in his view, it can't be retrieved. And that's what then plunges him into, I think, nothing short of a kind of metaphysical despair. And that's this twofold, this dualistic aspect to Nietzsche, I think, isn't it? On the one hand, the metaphysical despair, on the one hand, the sense that we have in Zarathustra of life being absurd, that humankind is crossing this rope across the abyss and we're waiting to tumble into the abyss. That line where he talks about, that life is absurd, and at any moment we might become aware of its absurdity. Hmm. That's the bad news. But of course, Nietzsche is also the philosopher of good news, which is, right, well, the abyss gives us lots of possibilities. There's lots of space. It means that it's something for us to climb out of. God is dead, but therefore our will should say, says Zarathustra, let the Superman live. And there is this, perhaps sometimes rhetorically hysterical optimism that's there in Nietzsche, but that's the kind of twin tracks that he goes down. Mm. And I think that's what makes him it makes him easy to misrepresent, as so often happens. But he is, as it were, a philosopher for all our moods, both the darkness and the despair, but also these chinks of light that we might be able to create a space for ourselves. And that's what he's doing, I think, in The Gay Science, the book, which has the very famous parable of the man who goes looking for God at midday and can't find him, and then tells the people in the marketplace that God is dead and we have killed him. There's also this sense of a space and opportunity that's opening up. I think that's what Steiner's buying into as well. And in a way, strategically, I think Steiner, we could say, Steiner certainly fills that space, because there's an awful lot of Steiner and there's an awful lot of history and various other activities that of an intellectual and economic kind that Steiner gets involved in and so on. So he certainly fills that space. I'm not sure whether Nietzsche would have been entirely convinced by the kind of space filling that Steiner does, but I think Steiner is certainly intuitively taking advantage of a space that's opened up by Nietzsche.
I'm going off the questions here, so I apologize. But there's one more I want to throw at you as a Germanist, which is actually to bring in a little bit of Spengler, if that's okay.
By all means.
Well, it's something you mentioned there. I mean, we're speaking about the problem of textuality, sort of problem of to be quite lazy, the finicky nature of language is all you have.
Yeah.
And language itself enters into a history of philology, of how people have consistently analyzed the Bible, you know, catechisms after catechisms after the equivalent of conferences and councils throughout time. And I'm thinking of the beginning of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, a moment, and this is, I haven't read it in full for a long while, so I may have got this incorrect or read this incorrectly, but a moment that always stands out to me in the book, which is, I think, is often overlooked because it's right at the beginning, is when Zarathustra is descending the mountain. He finds a sort of saint-like figure, if I'm remembering correctly, in the woods.
That's
sort of has a very quick conversation with this saint-like figure and then leaves them be. And thinking about this, this seems to me like almost a representative of the Spenglerian age of faith. You know, it's nice to meet you here in this, it's nice to meet you here in this idyllic woods. You've clearly actually got faith from that age. I'm going to leave you be. But where I'm going and what I've just learned, you know, as Spengler would say, we're now in the second religiosity. We're not in an age of faith anymore. In a way, like, you know, trying to tie this all together, we're in an age of the Logos, or in an age of philology, and we can't go back. But Zarathustra, I remember, the reason I really like that scene is Zarathustra, I remember, is quite kind compared to later in the novel. He sort of says, no, you've got something that we don't have anymore. You're like the last of its kind. I don't know if I'm misreading that, but do you see that as a historical progression that's happening here as well for Nietzsche?
I think, James, that's very, very persuasive account of these the very early two sections in Zarathustra. There is a kind of a parodic intent, I think, in this encounter, which is in the very very second section of the prologue. When he's wandering through the forest, and as you say, he comes across the figure of the saint, and they have this kind of bantering conversation together. And Zarathustra says, "Well, so what do you get up to in the woods here, all on your own and some?" And the saint says, "Oh, I make songs and sing them, and this is how I praise God and so on." There's this strange description that the narrative voice makes at this point. He says, the old man and Zarathustra and the old man take leave from each other, laughing in the way that two young lads laugh. Gleich wie zwei Knaben lachen. So I don't know, are these sort of, you know, is this comparing them to the divine twins or the Dioscuri? Zarathustra is full of these strange little rhetorical moments, which I at any rate find baffling and have never found a commentary suitably attentive to. And it's in this context that he then moves at the end of that second section of the prologue to say, how can it be possible? This old man, this old saint in his wood, has still not yet heard that God is dead. And I think that what I would take away from that is partly there's this referencing of the immediately preceding work, The Gay Science, with the Madman parable and the death of God. But he's restating it now to say that I think this is a moment which is, you know, past its declaration. How can somebody not have heard about it? How can somebody not be afflicted by worries and angst about their belief or about the consequences of the lot of it? How is this actually possible? And so, again, we have this, the first of several reasons in which, or ways in which Gandhi can be said to be dead, which are then presented in elsewhere in Zarathustra, that he died because of his pity for mankind, for humankind is one, his laugh to death, he laughs himself to death because of the other gods. And then finally, and most mysteriously, in the fourth part of Zarathustra, God, we're told, had been killed by the ugliest man, a figure who is often associated with Socrates. Socrates, about whom Nietzsche himself, of course, has an extraordinarily ambivalent view. But since we're talking about Zarathustra, the immediately preceding passage, the very first one in the prologue, I think sets out this full ambiguity of the way that Nietzsche regards a religion. First of all, because Zarathustra, when he goes off up into the mountain, is 30 years old, and of course it's when he's 30 years old that Christ is said to have gone into the desert. When he goes in the gospel story into the desert, Christ is, of course, famously tempted by the devil. Zarathustra doesn't have the temptation, but he does have this dialogue with the sun, which he addresses. Of course, Zoroaster is Zoroastrianism historically involves worship of the sun. So there's kind of a little referencing to that when Zarathustra actually addresses the sun and says, "Oh, great star, what would be your happiness if you did not have us for you to illuminate?" And then he says, "I have all this wisdom which I want to share with people. I am overrich in my wisdom. Therefore, I have to descend into the depths. Like you," he says to the sun, "have to go into the depths. I have to untergehen. I have to descend," as human being calls it. And he says to the sun, "I want you to bless the cup, the chalice that wants to overflow and bring this luminosity down into the world. This chalice wants to become empty again, and Zarathustra wants to become human again." And it's hard not to see in this a kind of referencing of the theological notion of kenosis, the divine emptying, which happens when Christ is incarnated. And again, what that little word that's tucked in there when Nietzsche tells us, Zarathustra says, "I want to become human again." So it opens up, isn't he already human? Just that little word there, I find, is so full of interpretive possibilities that we have some kind of a parody of the Bible, seems to me absolutely clear from the overall style of Zarathustra. But even in the level of granular detail in that prologue, which you mentioned, I think we can find Nietzsche engaging with some of the most profound theological ideas. And in this case, in particular, this notion of kenosis, the divine self-emptying, which happens in the act of the incarnation.
Which does bring us swiftly to one of the earlier discussions in your book, one of the earlier chapters, which is the historical Jesus. So this notion of to become human again. Well, you know, Nietzsche has a lot of discussion on the historical Jesus. Does he ever come to a conclusion as to who this figure was? I mean, I guess one question is, for some people, Jesus wasn't even a real figure. That seems to be fairly well disproved empirically speaking. But you know, who was Jesus? I guess literally for Nietzsche.
Yeah. I think that's a good question, because that does go to the heart of it. In a way, I'm not sure if the empirical debate is quite so open or closed as maybe you're suggesting there. Mm-hmm. I certainly think it's worthwhile noting that the very radical position that's taken by some critics that Jesus does not exist historically, and then there's a debate that's going on about it in France at the moment. Michel Onfray, who I think we've talked about a number of occasions, brought out a book last year called Théorie de Jésus, Biographie d'une idée, so the biography of an idea. And Onfray is someone who will, I think, very cheerfully tell you, no, Christ does not exist as a historical figure. In this respect, Onfray and other critics, I think, are far more radical than Nietzsche. Nietzsche looks quite tame by comparison, because there does seem to be an acceptance that there was a historical Jesus. And I point to the remark that he makes that there was only one Christian and he died on the cross. Whether, however, we can retrieve the teaching, the doctrine, the meaning of that historical figure is, however, I think, much less clear as far as Nietzsche is concerned, because in a way, Nietzsche is much less interested in Jesus. And he kind of, you know, leaves a sort of argumentational space around him there, because the real enemy that he wants to confront is, of course, St. Paul, because we only approach, his argument will be that we only approach a Christ as a historical figure through the theological lens of Paul. And the argument is that Paul misuses Christ to set up for his own nefarious interpretive purposes, and in fact thereby invents Christianity, and the real message of Christianity is lost irretrievably forever, thanks to St. Paul. And that's why there are several passages where Nietzsche is absolutely vituperative about St. Paul, whom he describes as a figure full of hate and ressentiment. Ressentiment, of course, is the one thing you shouldn't have, according to Nietzsche, who presents us with this false Christ, and everything that's happened subsequently in the terms of the establishing of the church and the spread of Christianity has all been a terrible disaster. It's meant the betrayal of the legacy of everything that was great, thanks to the Greeks and thanks to the Romans, and has landed us in this these 2,000 years of mess, and it's all down to St. Paul.
But it isn't all down to St. Paul, though, because we also have primarily we have the Synoptic Gospels. So what is they all banded together, or, you know, why does St. Paul get the brunt of this? We might have discussed this in The Antichrist briefly, but so, and I guess philologically speaking, this is the question here.
Yeah, no. I think we touched on it, but it's worthwhile revisiting it in the context of the discussion here. I think the argument would go along the lines of the epistles of St. Paul are the earlier documents, are the earliest discussions that we have about Christian theology. And it's significant the things that they don't mention. And certainly the whole kind of biographical aspects of the life of Christ, as we might think about it, the virgin birth, the trial, the crucifixion, the resurrection, these aren't there in St. Paul. So the earliest documents that are witnessing to Christianity don't mention these points, or if they do, they do so in a highly elusive way. It's not that they're not documents of belief. I mean, they're full of theological depth and richness, but they're decidedly, if you read the epistles of Paul, it's very hard to make the kind of picture of yourself of Christ that you would have in comparison to reading the Gospels, which are at least half a century later, and which then have a very interesting and complex, and again, probably not entirely retrievable philological history as to how they came to be written. It's in the course of the 19th century that classical philologists start to use the techniques that they're using on classical texts on biblical ones. I should be fair to say the 18th century, but it really gets going in the 19th century. And is there in the discussions, though, about, which comes first? Consensus seems to be that Mark was written first. Did they borrow from each other? How did this sort of cutting and pasting happen? And then the theory has been put forward in the end of the late 20th century that we can construct nothing less than a kind of missing gospel, which is referred to as the Gospel of Q, in the work of people like John Kloppenborg, who say, well, you can actually work out from what we have at the end of this process how the Gospels came to be written as textual documents. And you can pursue it along textual documents and provide an argument, which means you don't have to have any of the theological infrastructure in order to explain how they came into being. And I think that in a way is an extension of an argument that one finds in Nietzsche. And again, Nietzsche is in many respects quite tame compared with Dutch school of radical criticism, say. I'm not quite sure why that is, whether Nietzsche has a kind of lasting melancholy about the impossibility of belief, because he can also see belief as something which is very beautiful and very powerful as well. And in a way, Zarathustra is all about making us want to believe not simply in ourselves, but believe in the Übermensch, whoever and whatever that might be.
So this is a question that I put you before ask you before we started recording that came to me the other night. In speaking of the death of God philologically, in relation to what you've just said, you know, throughout history, this ability for us as potential believers to truly engage with the message of Christ is like a sort of 2,000 year long game of Chinese whispers with 1,001 agendas attached to it at all times. Eventually, this whole thing, you know, we have no ability to truly understand in philological terms what is actually meant by what we have been given textually by the Bible. And so the foundation unto which you approach Christianity is so shaky that what have you even got to start with? So that is how Nietzsche approaches Christianity and Christian texts. But at the same time, when he writes and speaks of Greeks and ancient Greek myths, he writes with a real certainty. So why is that philology not as troublesome?
Yeah. Okay. Now, I think that's a very shrewd observation. I think I'd begin by again just pausing on that point that you made at the beginning about the extent of the problem as Nietzsche sees it. I mean, he writes in Human, All Too Human, he says, a certain false psychology, a certain kind of imaginativeness in the interpretation of motives and experience is the essential preliminary to being a Christian and to experiencing the need of salvation. So again, this is a point about philology. It can also be extended, I think, to a point about psychoanalysis, and I think psychology. I think Freud would be very sympathetic to this line of argumentation as well, and may well indeed have actually borrowed it from Nietzsche, which is another discussion. And in this passage, Nietzsche goes on to say, upon gaining an insight into this wandering of the reason and the imagination, one ceases to be a Christian. And I think this is a very, very powerful point for him. He's saying, we know too much. We simply can't roll back the clock in this way. It's, if you want, you like, what makes Nietzsche a confessor of modernity. This is the modern condition as he sees it. And I think one could say, well, you know, gaining an insight into the wandering of philological reason and interpretive imagination, this makes one cease to be a Christian. And I think your point about, well, hang on. If we know how texts came to be written in the classical world, we can apply that to the Christian world, and that leads to the end of the classical world. Why doesn't that, you know, retrospectively apply to the way that he views the Greek world as well? And I think it's to do with what Nietzsche finds when he reads classical texts. Right? Mm. I think his objection to the Bible is that when you read it, And Nietzsche does like some parts of the Bible. He likes the Old Testament. He likes sort of prophets, and he likes the confidence with which the children of Israel go forth. So he's not entirely negative about the Bible. Can't stand the New Testament. Says you have to wear gloves when you're reading it, and so on. And I think it's because of what he finds there. And by contrast, there's a passage written when he's doing his stint of teaching at Basel, where he says, this is what classical philology can offer you. He says, however dark the world might be, if one suddenly introduces into it a piece of Hellenic life, it immediately brightens up. They, that is the Greeks, transfigure the history of antiquity and are in fact a place of refuge for every serious human being. So he says, I hope I've showed you the task of philology as a means of transfiguring one's existence and that of the rising generation. So what he finds when he reads the Greeks is something is just a completely different content from what he finds when reading the Bible. When you're reading the New Testament, he says you're finding a philological hoax. That's, I think, the position that he takes from it. But he says, when you read the Greeks, that's not what they're about at all. And they do have this transfiguring capacity, which he thinks has a salvific function even today. It's a very powerful argument for teaching the classics.
Well, I'm not going to avoid a chance to find to get another German into the discussion. One of both of our favorites, Ludwig Klages.
Go for it.
Is the irony here? It's, you know, from that difference between the Greeks and the Bible, is the irony here that, and also in what you're saying about sort of psychoanalysis in the respect that we had still have to have this function of imagination, we could almost say mythos, you know, maybe even a childlike approach to things, and even the Bible says that, ironically. Is it the paradox that Geist has made it so, you know, a little bit of a play on words here. Geist has made it so we can't approach Geist. Or Geist has made it so we can't approach the spirit. This philological...
So we can't approach the Heideggergeist.
Heideggergeist, there you go. I mean, Klages, of course, would, you know, throw all the Geists out. But it seems that this philological approach or this philological problem that we're within, you know, inability to reverse it. Because once the ball of philology, which itself seems to be inherently deconstructive, analytical, logocentric, Geist infected, you can't, you know, unroll that trajectory. And so as soon as that's going, as soon as that wedge has come down, the Heiliggeist is off limits.
I think you're absolutely right to bring Klages into this discussion as someone who picks up this this Nietzschean ball and runs with it a little bit further. I think I'd say though that in some respects and in a crucial respect, there is a similarity in methodological approach between Klages and Nietzsche, which is to say. And however powerful the critique and unrelenting the critique is of Geist in Klages' philosophy, nevertheless he retains something of Geist in the way that he presents that philosophy. And I think this is the point that he makes when he's defending himself against the accusation of irrationalism and so on, is that he says, no, what I've tried to do is to use ratio to undermine ratio. I've tried to use reason to undermine reason. It's one of the reasons why I think Klages actually uses this term of deconstruction a long time before our friend Derrida gets his hand on it. And one might argue that Klages is the more enthusiastic, more authentic deconstructionist than even Derrida is. Because if one only has to look at a Klagesian sentence, long, massive, grammatically extremely complicated and very hard to read, to see this is not someone who is a kind of crude irrationalist in that sense, someone who's actually working, and I'm sure you'd agree, at the very highest levels of ratio and reason. And that there is there's a passage where he says that what he's trying to do in The Spirit as Adversary of the Soul is to use the spirit against the spirit. And I think that there is exactly that sense that we find with Nietzsche as well, that he's trying to use the philological aspects of theology as he has become aware of them and that we've talked about earlier in this discussion, to use them to put an end to these theological misunderstandings.
To read again, as he would say.
Absolutely.
So this is sort of the end, in a way, of his, not the end of his philology, but this is the method, as you mentioned. Methods are of the utmost importance here. What is it to read again?
Absolutely right. I think the key word there is we have to learn. He says how something is handed down, he says, is usually the text itself. how something is handed down is usually the text itself. And there we find, I suppose, in Nietzsche, that the whole point about his insistence on the importance of genealogy. Once we realize how something has come into being, we understand it in a way which you can't if you just look at the final endpoint. So that's why the genealogy of morals in Nietzsche's view uncovers the lack of morality, the immorality of morality, because it's based on his account on ressentiment and negativity, and that's what makes it such a bad thing. So morality and his view of it is essentially immoral. So you have this kind of curious double maneuver of I'm going to attack morality, but I'm going to do so in the name of morality. And I think that this happens again in his view of the relationship between philology and theology. He says, how something's handed down is usually the text itself. We have to learn to read again. In other words, we have to become aware of how texts are produced, what are the motives and factors and energies and motives that go on into textual production, he says. We have to learn to read again something which, with the predominance of the printed word, we've forgotten how to do. And I think that here his critique is, well, it applies to a world which is full of published books and a fortiori even more to our world, which is full of virtual books and so on. We are surrounded by text and print and language. And in all of this, we have forgotten how to read it. We're unable to interpret. We're unable to find ourselves in what Rilke might say is an interpretable world. And I think in this sense, what Nietzsche is showing is being concerned about biblical interpretation is not just some sort of niche activity. And he's not being nasty about people who go to Sunday school simply because he's an unpleasant old man, but rather because he sees that there is something of great existential urgency to this. And that's why I think we need to go back and, in this respect, read Nietzsche himself again.
I mean, I'm sure Nietzsche probably also intended this, but this notion of what's been handed down is the text itself. This notion of philological deconstruction by returning to the origin, and I think then of this almost, dare I say it, another foot towards hell, panicked emphasis on authority that we see at the beginning of the Bible, or the beginning of how the Bible has been constructed. Quite literally called Genesis. And, you know, you'll have many priests say, if you start reading it, forget the begats, you know, skip the begats. But the point of the begats is to trace this lineage right back. And there's sort of a kind of crafty Nietzschean joke there of going, okay, we've gone all the way back, but what is this, you know, pointing at the text itself. So that's quite ingenious. So, much in the way that, you were speaking of Klage's Geist against Geist, it's origin against origin, Genesis against Genesis, except Nietzsche's holding the actual Bible and saying that.
Yeah, I think you're actually right. It is incredibly clever and shrewd. It's also something which, in a way, isn't the most obvious aspect of Nietzsche's work, because he assumes that he takes for granted that we know so much about it in the way which is no longer the case. I think I'd also want to make the point that reading Nietzsche about the Bible, it is a great way of actually going back and looking at the biblical text itself. I don't think it's entirely misreading Nietzsche if one finds oneself going back and looking at biblical commentary. And there is something, the passage I was talking about from Daybreak, when he criticizes Christian philology and so on. But it is also one could make the counter argument against Nietzsche, the basic cultural source of where we come from in Western philosophy and metaphysics, as linguistic human beings, as interpretive human beings, our experience of the Bible and interpreting the Bible, for good or for ill, Nietzsche thinks for ill, and shapes us and determines us in a way which is absolutely fundamental for us to understand. And I think your point there about authority, Is that because we've kind of latched onto this idea that despite what deconstructionists tell us, that text does have a particular meaning. And this search for the authoritative meaning which governs so much theological discourse, we might say, has now moved into other realms as well, more dangerously into political realms where people want to find an authority figure. We can see all too clearly from history where that ends, but I'm thinking about what's happening in the world at the moment. It would seem that we still haven't really fully learned that lesson and the consequences.
What do you think it is to read Nietzsche again?
It's not to be able to simply say, right, done that, read it, got the book, and go away and forget it. Because I don't think it works like that. I think he is such a powerful communicator. He is so elusive, and in some senses elusive in the way that he expresses himself. I think that one can read him as kind of, you know, the ultimate disconfirmation of religious belief. But it's also interesting that in the 20th century, his work has been continually picked up by philosophers and thinkers, most notably those of a Christian persuasion. I mean, you know, it's a long list. One could talk about Charles Maurras, Giovanni Papini, Nikolai Hartmann, Max Scheler, Henri de Lubac, Gabriel Marcel, Emmanuel Meunier, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, Eric Chavara, to whom Hermetics devoted a fascinating broadcast, Cornelio Fabbro, Romano Guardini, René Girard. I'm going to stop on René Girard because he's perhaps the most timely one. All of these thinkers engage in one way or another with Nietzsche, and surprisingly, very often productively. Paul Tillich would be another name of someone whom I should mention, who find in Nietzsche almost a kind of new revelation, almost a kind of a new source of a biblical inspiration. It is remarkable how many 20th century theologians engage explicitly and in many cases productively and positively with Nietzsche. And the same, I think, goes for literature as well, particularly in France. You've got great poets like Paul Claudel, Francis Jam, Charles Péguy, Marie Noël, Patrice de la Tour du Pin, who was greatly involved with the Vatican II liturgy reforms and so on. So on the one hand, Nietzsche tells us God is dead. There are a lot of people who don't think he is. Mm. That's a matter of fact as well.
The key word there, though, don't think he is, right? Still, you know, still a problem of faith and that imaginative faculty. But one question I want to ask, I guess, is there's so many ways to approach Nietzsche. I mean, one can read Zarathustra as a work of literature, as a work of philosophy, as a work of theology, as we've sort of been describing here, if one wished. And so there's so many approaches. And to say Nietzsche's just a philosopher would be incorrect. What do you think is missing? Or do you think we're getting a lopsided Nietzsche if we don't approach his work without this knowledge that from the very beginning of his writing, perhaps except those early essays with Schopenhauer, etc., from the very beginning, he has this very deep understanding of the role language plays. And he is, as you mentioned with Zarathustra, with this Become Human, again, just these little bits here and there that he has a deep philological understanding of what language over time can do. And so to approach him without the understanding that that is going on at all times, yeah. Do you think we're getting a sort of lopsided picture of his philosophy, of his work?
Yes, I think I'd agree with that assessment, and to link that back to your previous question about, you know, what does it mean to read Nietzsche again? The Heidelberg Academy of Sciences has embarked on a quite remarkable exercise of producing a series of commentaries on Nietzsche's works, the Nietzsche Commentar. So here's a good opportunity for everybody to brush up their German. And go and dive into these volumes. It's an extraordinary exegetical exercise. I mean, you know, they're chunky books. They're several hundred pages long for each of the texts. If you're going to try and read, for example, Nietzsche's essay on David Friedrich Strauss, who is another key aspect, another one of the people who kind of pushes Nietzsche over the brink into disbelief, as it were. Now, very hard, despite the work of Frederick Beiser, who's done a biography of David Friedrich Strauss, very hard to orientate oneself around Nietzsche's essay on Strauss. The new Nietzsche commentar that's come out is invaluable, I think, in trying to contextualize Nietzsche's argument. They're a really useful resource. Probably recommend them to people. I know they're German, but German is dead easy as a language, as I keep telling people. And also, they are available as open access books. It's an incredibly generous gesture on the part of the Heidelberg Academy of Sciences. And every time I open up one of these to look at a passage, I'm made to think, goodness, there's an awful lot that I still don't know. And so to keep on reading and to use Nietzsche as a way of thinking oneself back into the sources of our culture and the critique of our culture is kind of, in a way, an adventure that never ends.
Speaking of ends, is there anything you'd like to add about your book that there is, you know, there is... it's a fairly long book. There's a lot more in there, but is there anything you'd like to add that's key?
No, I think I'd just like to say thanks for the opportunity to discuss it. I certainly enjoyed writing the book, so I hope that people will enjoy reading it as well. I just wanted to end with a quotation, if I may, from not one of my favorites, C.G. Jung, who says this in Memories, Dreams, Reflection. He says, "Today we need psychology for reasons that involve our very existence. The Christian nations have come to a sorry pass. Their Christianity slumbers and has neglected to develop its myth further in the course of the centuries. Those who gave expression to the dark stirrings of myth, stirrings of growth in mythic ideas, were refused a hearing. Joachim of Fiore, Meister Eckhart, Jakob Boehme, and many others have remained obscurantists for the majority. Our myth has become mute and gives no answers." So there's an awful lot more that we could talk about, and I'm sure you'll cover this on future Hermetics programs. Joachim of Fiore, Meister Eckhart, Jakob Boehme, obscurantists, Dunkelmeier, Jung reads them, but there they are, and I'm sure they need to be discovered as well.
I'll be sure to put links for Discourses of Philology and Theology in Nietzsche in the description below, as well as links to our other discussions. Are you currently working on another book on Nietzsche?
Thank you very much. I'm currently working on a book about Jung and Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival. I'm going back to the Middle Ages. Perhaps I'll discover myself there.
Paul Bishop, once again, thanks very much.
Thank you.